Welcome to the Human Rights 2020s podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. These podcasts are all about how we can protect and promote human rights in Scotland. My name is Barry Snowden, coordinator of the consortium, and I'm really pleased to welcome Matt Rice from the Open Rights Group to talk about digital rights in our post-Brexit UK. So Matt, before we get into all the different issues, could you tell us a bit about yourself and a bit about the Open Rights Group?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast. So my name's Matthew Rice. I'm the Scotland Director for Open Rights Group. I've been in the digital rights space, so to speak, for, God, maybe about 10 years. This is like the first time I've been asked to make a calculation of how long I've been at this for. Yeah, so roughly 10 years. I used to work for an organisation called Privacy International, where I got to run campaigns internationally and work in different countries, like in Colombia and Pakistan, things like that. And then a couple of years ago, came back up with an opportunity to actually do digital rights campaigning in Scotland from Open Rights Group. Open Rights Group are a grassroots, membership-based digital rights campaigning organisation. So predominantly based in London and focused across the UK. The reason that I even exist in my role as Scotland Director is because the importance of digital in our lives has grown so hugely, and there have been differences in direction between the Scottish Government and the UK Government that Open Rights Group felt it was really important to kind of introduce a fully staffed workflow in Scotland, working on things like digital identity, police use of mobile phone data, biometrics, any kind of aspects of digital. And so I've been at that for a good few years now.
Cool. I think it's interesting. I think it's something that we're only all just beginning to think more about, but I greatly appreciate that you've thought about a lot of these things already. But if you, this might sound a daft question, but if you talk about digital rights, what are you talking about really?
I've always personally struggled with the question or notion of digital rights, because the way I view it is that when we're talking about digital rights, we're still fundamentally talking about human rights. So as Open Rights Group explains on its website, we focus on three main areas of work. That is the right to privacy online in terms of consumer privacy and our relationship with groups like Facebook and Google. And then we have government surveillance, which is a kind of distinct question around privacy. And then a third stream is freedom of expression online, which is about freedom of access to information, combating state or private sector censorship. But even with those three streams, you can see that they are still fundamentally questions about your fundamental right to privacy, your right to freedom of expression, which includes access to information. And in a way, while we say digital rights, it kind of gives us a sense of like, oh, these people talk about technology more than they just talk about anything else. Really, when you boil it down, we're still talking about the relationship this has to the Human Rights Act 1998, or the relationship this has to the Charter for Fundamental Rights in the European Union. So if I was to make a much longer winded description, I would say it's an organisation that's focused on human rights in the digital age, but we have only a certain amount of time to ever do our elevator pitches. And so digital rights is what we call it.
That makes sense. It is a, yeah, like that, human rights in the digital age. So it's almost, there are a lot of emerging issues that we need to be thinking about related to human rights, whether it may be new or look new. At least. So particularly today, we're looking at digital rights in the sort of post-Brexit. So as we all know, we've now left the EU on the 31st of January, which seems like a long time ago now. And we're in the middle of this sort of transition period where the law is the same, or mostly the same, and deals are being done. And there's been a lot of discussion about protecting rights after Brexit and general concern about. But should we be concerned about digital rights in particular?
Yeah, hugely. The role that our membership of the European Union has played in establishing digital rights in the United Kingdom, our standards that we accept as what we see day to day, is massive. Really, everything we see in digital rights or key to digital rights, particularly privacy, has emanated from our relationship with the European Union, and as a result is subject to change as a result of our exit.
Okay, so it has, the EU itself has actually protected our privacy rights in a way that the UK might not have done or wouldn't have done on their own.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the first instance, when we're talking about kind of consumer privacy generally, everyone will kind of recall that time in May a few years ago where you all got asked to provide your consent to staying on mailing lists, and it was super annoying and boring. But that was basically a very practical reality of new data privacy standards that were coming in via the General Data Protection Regulation that existed, developed, and has really been led by the European Union. The whole data protection agenda is basically a European project, one that Europe is incredibly protective of. While from a kind of commercial perspective, you've got tech giants that basically begin in the US and exist in the US, and that's our relationship, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Twitter. The European Union have seen their role as being, while not the kind of facilitator of huge tech giants, the rule setter for those tech giants if they want to come operate in the European Union, and ultimately a global standard for regulation. So basically kind of seen as like Europe's project in many ways. And as a result, the UK has played its part in it. And there have been really, really significant MEPs and civil servants that have operated in Europe. But it has really, like I said, started, operated from the European perspective. And again, as a result, that's going to change, particularly when we start thinking about our relationship with the US post-Brexit and our relationship with the European Union, because they will begin to treat the UK differently when it comes to data privacy standards from now on.
It's really interesting because I don't think when most people were thinking about Brexit, voting about Brexit things, discussing it, you know, data protection and data rights and privacy and things are not often kind of at the forefront, or we don't often think about it. So that's really interesting. Does that mean that the GDPR that you mentioned that has really come about because of the EU, does that mean that will be no more after Brexit, or will we still have that?
So we will still have it ostensibly because of the continuity legislation that the UK establishes. So data protection is a reserved matter. Scotland has very little scope to do something differently when it comes to that. It comes to data protection. The regulator, the Information Commissioner, is based in Manchester and Wilmslow. They have offices in Scotland, staffed by really good folks, but really it's a UK-based agenda that will change in line with the UK government. So that being said, on exit date, whenever that may be, the GDPR will become UK law immediately and will continue to apply for as long as that's the case. Ministers have said, we have the GDPR for now, which is a very kind of foreboding statement. No one quite knows what for now means or for how long, but there's clearly been statements about wanting to cut what they would consider to be regulatory burdens, make things easier for business. All of that is kind of, on the other side, means less standards when it comes to data privacy, potentially reducing the protections that the General Data Protection Regulation provides.
So is that a big underlying concern that actually what might happen, not so much just now, but actually in the future, that rights might be reduced more than we'd wish them to? Are there things that need to happen now, or the UK government needs to do now in terms of their deals with the EU and their arrangements for post-Brexit that would protect our digital rights?
So one of the tricky things is that, particularly when it comes to privacy, the UK will become what's called like a third-party state, no longer a member. That meant that while you were a member, you applied the GDPR, and that meant that companies and the public sector bodies could access the personal data of EU citizens because those standards would apply directly. Once you are a third party or no longer a member of the European Union, the EU needs to make an assessment about whether or not you provide suitable standards to allow for European Union citizens' data to continue to be accessible by data controllers, so that's companies or public bodies in the United Kingdom. So before, there was no scrutiny because you were a member state. Now there is going to be scrutiny about the standards that the UK applies, not just when it comes to data protection, but also questions around your national surveillance laws and policing laws, the effectiveness of the regulator in enforcing and upholding these standards. All of this, which was in the past never asked about the UK, will now be on the table for this deliberation by the European Commission. And the general consensus from data protection experts is that the UK is at risk of not getting that approval. And that as a result, it's going to create frictions in an environment that doesn't really do well with friction. You know, data and digital is all about basically trying to create standards that allow for easy access to data with very little perceptible issues. Once you begin to start creating lines saying you cannot access European Union citizens' data from the UK here, or you, company X, need to put in special new measures so that we can ensure that you're respecting the standards that are expected of you, that's going to create friction and questions about, you know, how useful it is to remain in the UK for like operations, business operations. The piece around fundamental rights is that the Charter of Fundamental Rights, alongside your right to privacy, actually also grants you a fundamental right to data protection. So it's so important for the European Union. They basically said privacy is a thing, but data protection is also a thing unto itself. And so the Charter will no longer apply directly, and the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice will no longer be there. And that's been a hugely significant court for establishing quite stringent standards of data privacy. Even in the face of angering large US companies, the Court of Justice has taken quite profound decisions. Both of those things, the Charter and the European Court of Justice, will go. That's going to naturally change a lot of things in terms of what we have available to us as individuals to assert our rights. I realize this is quite a waffly answer, because what you asked were, are there things that the UK can do? The UK should be trying its best to get an adequacy assessment in place. The EU is reluctant to actually begin that process until the UK is officially no longer a member, rather than a kind of transitioning member, which we kind of are now, if you accept the kind of weird position that that creates. So there are things that the UK could be doing, such as committing to upholding data privacy standards, removing certain exemptions that they'd put in place around data rights, in particular one called the immigration exemption, which changes the access an individual can have to their personal data if it would prejudice effective immigration control, according to the UK government. They could better fund the ICO, provide it with stronger powers. These things will be significant, and they could also make sure that their surveillance laws are better and more up to scratch and more up to standard, because that's never been looked at by the European Commission before, but it's certainly been looked at by the European Court of Human Rights. And the UK has a pretty poor record when it comes to their surveillance laws in front of the European Court. So there's going to be another reckoning there that perhaps none of us even thought was going to be a big deal, but actually is going to be quite significant now. So that would be another piece to get to work on for the UK government, if I was setting their work plan.
If you were setting their work plan, that's good. So actually, although Brexit is technically done, we've left the EU, and even when the transition period's over, you're saying there are still things that the UK government could still get their adequacy assessment sorted. They could still take those steps to protect different aspects of privacy and data rights, which would mean there would be that frictionless flow between the UK and the EU. But it doesn't sound like people are too optimistic about that.
No. I mean, we already know that there's going to be a kind of divergence. Basically, it's already become like a known future direction for the UK government is that they're going to diverge on data protection standards. So my wish is really just a wish, because there is going to be a change. The UK will shift away from the standards that we've accepted. And just recently, the European Commission had published pieces saying that they really expect quite a high degree of convergence in standards, and that any divergence in standards will be met with an additional level of scrutiny. So they're basically heading at loggerheads for this. So not only could they make some like practical changes in terms of some of the kind of how they already operate data protection law in the UK under the Data Protection Act 2018, there's a kind of diplomacy that they could be operating under, and a better kind of sense of what their intentions are that would have quelled some of the kind of stronger language from the European Commission. But it seems like the UK government is not interested in making this easy. They are going to diverge. And the big thing about this is they're diverging. The question is in what direction? Basically, there's a tug of war, and the UK is in the middle of it. And it's between European Union standards of data protection and US standards of data economies and access to technology and access to personal data. The US does not have the same standards, not even close to the same standards, much less, much lower standards of data privacy. And the question and potential direction we're seeing is that that's where the UK is going to go, is towards the US.
Really interesting. I didn't realise, I've got to say, that there was that same issue that actually you hear a lot about around trade rules generally, around food and chlorinated chicken and that sort of things between that kind of US and EU and the UK in the middle.
We basically have like a digital chlorinated chicken issue that's like coming down the line. But yeah, like, so this, in terms of what comes next for folks, in terms of what they want to pay attention to, the UK-EU free trade agreement will be incredibly important, but equally important is going to be the UK-US free trade agreements. I'll admit that, like, even for us, digital trade, as it's becoming known, is a new area, one that we've kind of focused on for a couple of years, and some people have been involved in, like, these big, like, TTIP decisions, big multinational, multi-continent agreements. But really, a lot of this direction about where our rights will rest is now going to be in the matter of trade, which is not a great sign, not a great place for rights to go. But that would be the area that we'll have to begin to focus on.
As you say, how do you secure and absolutely ensure fundamental human rights within trade? So it's not just trade in the narrower sense, but actually includes those rights that really impacts individuals.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that it's not necessarily in this immediate trade deal, but actually it's the steps that come after that as well that will really show the route that the UK is going to take.
Yeah, that's right. So the EU has consistently said fundamental rights standards are not for trade negotiation. We have the Charter for Fundamental Rights, and that is what we abide by. And if you want to make a trade agreement with us, this isn't a part for discussion. We can discuss all these other parts around access to markets and things like that, but you will be accepting the standards of the Charter or GDPR, like the General Data Protection Regulation. So the EU, up until now, as the UK being a member, has basically said rights are not up for debate. UK has not said that. In fact, it said we're going to change some things. So yeah, it's going to be a, I can't really even sort of articulate the challenge because we've never seen it before. So I don't actually quite know what will happen, but I just know that the kind of lines that we thought of as established and solid, just like the effect of Brexit anyway, those lines are going to disappear. And there's going to be what used to be considered to be, oh, right, that's a red line, we'll never cross that. It's now going to be, we need to figure out whether or not we're about to negotiate away our fundamental rights to privacy.
It's like a lot of things around protection of human rights after Brexit, some of the devil is in the detail. I immediately noticed the little bits of change, but we need to be keeping an eye on them and be concerned about them, I guess.
Yeah.
That's really helpful.
I mean, the thing to keep in mind as well is that while I've kind of sat quite loftily in talking about fundamental rights and things like that, the effect of, or like the importance of digital is going to just grow and grow. So it becomes less about our role with, say, our relationship as consumers with Facebook, but it'll become about questions of how we want our criminal justice sector to operate. Standards that have been set, again, by the European Union through GDPR have involved things around significant automated decision-making in the form of artificial intelligence cannot be done if it produces a legal or similarly significant effect on that individual. And if that occurs, the individual is entitled to having an explanation from a human about how that decision was made. You know, let me understand how your algorithm operates, right?
So are we talking about, make this as simple as possible, right? So, So in terms of artificial intelligence, are you talking about if there's decision-making made in like healthcare or something that you should be able to challenge that and have someone else, there should be controls on that and that those are a bit at risk?
That's right. Yeah. So when we think about it, when I was talking about the criminal justice sector, it could be something like, which has already been used in the UK, like sentencing algorithms. So looking at a person's previous history of criminal activity and then deciding on recommendation to the judge, this person should get like 12 years rather than 6 years. If that was to occur, now the individual would be entitled to demand an explanation as to how that decision was made, which would require an understanding of the artificial intelligence, like the system, the algorithm. You need to begin to explain it and kind of unpick it. The US doesn't like that as an idea because it's seen to be because so much of this is developed by private companies, it's seen as trade secrets or the intellectual property of that company. So here's the kind of nightmare scenario, is that the UK exits the European Union, waters down that standard of right to an explanation from automated decision making, brings in some kind of fancy sentencing algorithm that's been trained in the US, which begins to say, recommend sentences for black males to be higher than on average white males. You wouldn't be able to kind of immediately scrutinize that algorithm for perhaps making really, really substantial bias errors, because the US has said in its UK, in its free trade agreement, you cannot oblige a company to provide its intellectual property to you, or you cannot make trade secrets something to be revealed. So here's that's a kind of weird nightmare scenario, that all of a sudden we have a lot less transparency when it comes to the role that technology plays, which we think will only increase in our daily lives, in really significant parts of our lives, from something like criminal justice, but also things like healthcare. And so these things, this kind of like departure of like, oh, this lofty GDPR thing goes, actually could have quite profound practical effects on people's trust of the criminal justice system, our general level of understanding, and our right to hold it to account. But they could ultimately end up in people being sent to jail for longer than they should because of the colour of their skin, for instance.
Thank you, that's scary stuff, actually. And it's just that all those transparency kind of rights built within that. So if you don't know why decisions were made, you just can't challenge them, you can't understand them, you have no way of advocating around it. And it strikes me that some of those same issues around, as you mentioned, the immigration exemption, that if you don't know why decisions were made in the immigration system, you can't get the information, then how can you challenge it? So it's really a fundamental balance of power between the decision maker and the person who's affected by it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's that kind of imbalance of power is the thing that European standards have grappled with for a long time. Whether the UK accepts that same necessity to recognise that and make kind of suitable changes is one thing. Whether it can make those changes because of like agreements it makes with other countries, because it's in a weaker position on its negotiating position with big companies like countries like the US or China, neither of whom actually like lots of regulation, but for different reasons. Yeah, we may be in a position where you're a kind of a minor partner trying to just negotiate a slice of this, and you have to accept standards that in no way would be in the kind of general public interest.
What priority they put to this, to these rights being protected, and how much they're willing to sort of trade them away to get other benefits, I guess. Give us another practical example of that tussle between the US approach to protecting rights and the sort of the EU protection of rights with the UK in between. Is there another example that we'd know what it looks like in our kind of normal life?
We'd know what it looks like in our normal life. Yeah, there could be some that come further. So another one would be, so because the US doesn't have any federal data privacy laws, there's no distinct standard about how personal data of an individual should be treated. There are different states in the US that have like taken it upon themselves. So California, for instance, is seen as like this leader, which has got a thing called the California Consumer Privacy Act, which kind of models itself quite a lot on European standards. But the one thing it doesn't do is require a lawful basis for data controllers, companies, public bodies, to process personal data. So one of the things that GDPR standards require, and thus the UK requires, is that if you're going to use Barry's data or Matthew's data, you need to have a reason why you're going to use it. You need to make clear to Matthew and Barry why you're going to use their data. You could use it based on their consent, in which you tell them, these are all the things I'm going to do with your data. Or you might have some other things, such as you signed a contract with them, or you have, which again is like another opportunity for a person to read through and be like, oh, you're going to do that with my data. I don't like that. By removing like the requirement for a lawful basis under the California Consumer Privacy Act, there could be a situation where, and again, that'd be a huge plank to change for UK citizens, is that you would no longer have a kind of ability to understand, well, how have you got my data and what are you doing with it and under what law are you doing it under? The practical reality would be kind of like, actually, people might quite like it, but when you land on a website now, you have to kind of accept cookies and say, do you accept and join these things, which is annoying. But for a data privacy geek like myself, which I try and wear with pride as a title, that stuff is like a modicum of control that you can go, I'm going to see how many people are like watching my reading of The Guardian to decide what adverts are going to send me. And I'll just switch a few of these off because I don't like that idea. You would no longer have that cookie banner in front of you if you're accessing a US system, for instance. Or potentially if the UK goes so far to remove it entirely, you wouldn't have it for many services that you might access if it's provided for in the UK. And so you would see a kind of removal of that like requirement to say okay. But what it would mean practically is you would just know less about what's going on with your data. Granted, not many people do spend a lot of time trying to figure out what goes on with the data, but I do insist that when you do spend some time thinking about it, it's actually quite interesting. And you can do quite a lot in telling them to stop doing it. But it all bases itself around, have you got standards in place that these groups need to abide by that you can then exercise? And again, they basically emanate from Europe and are not in the interest of the US government, as we can see from even the most kind of privacy progressive state, like the California Consumer Privacy Act. They still weren't able to go as far as to say, just put it on a par with Europe. And so that disconnect is always going to be there in some form or another.
I think we're all going to go and check exactly what data is actually being held about us that we didn't realise. But it does sound like, is that very everyday control over your own data and knowing what different companies hold is quite sort of fundamental. But some of these scenarios they're not now, they're still kind of nightmare scenarios that are sort of somehow possible now that we're out of the EU. I presume from an open rights group point of view, you're keeping an eye on those little steps that we might end up getting there and try and stop it before it keeps us.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing our best. I think anybody that's tried to kind of follow the kind of local or domestic legislative debates will know how tricky it can be, particularly when things stop being about primary legislation and start to be questions about ministerial powers to change things. So things under secondary legislation or statutory instruments where you don't need to request permission of the parliament to make a change. You are empowered to do it because you are a minister in the government. Quite a lot of the European standards have fallen into that track where they can be removed or altered significantly. Not, I wouldn't say as far as say removed, but can be significantly altered by a minister without a lot of scrutiny. And there actually just isn't a very good monitoring mechanism for it at this stage, but it's one that I think needs to be in place, particularly if that's going to be an area where significant changes, alterations will be made to standards. So I'd say that, you know, when it comes, it's been incredibly useful to work with certain groups like the Public Law Project and their SIFT project, which is around monitoring statutory instruments. But there isn't enough of that going on because we just weren't prepared for something like that. And the other piece to this is that going back to the digital trade problem is that digital trade or trade agreements generally are not subject to the approval of Parliament. They are a thing that the government can sign themselves. So while the European Parliament is required to consent to European trade negotiations, the UK domestic Parliament has no such role. It would only be if the minister decides they want to give people an update on the process of a trade agreement. But actually, we're kind of back into smoke-filled rooms, or like vape-filled rooms, I guess, maybe. We don't smoke so much anymore. But like, it's back into those kind of backroom deals where you didn't really think your rights were going to end up again. You'd always have a chance to fight in Parliament and speaking to your representative. But when it comes to trade, and if it's going to be as significant as we're concerned it would be, it's going to be really difficult to put on like a front of accountability. And it's one area that, you know, we think is vital. It's happening now. The trade bill is being discussed around what role does Parliament play in approving future trade agreements. And basically, you know, it's being walked through as the government wants it, which is, we'll decide, we'll let you know, but you don't have any power to stop, or we don't have to ask for your consent or the consent of the kind of public as a result to sign up to these large trade agreements.
Interesting, because I think for those of us watching the Brexit debates, those Henry VIII powers sort of discussions that seem like an age ago are actually really crucial, actually, when it comes down to the details of our rights, isn't it? Because, as you say, it means they either know what's happening or you really don't. And either MPs, the power of the parliament and MPs, and then you, through your MP, have a chance of having a say or you don't. So it's that, those age-old almost, it feels like, Brexit debates are becoming very real when you look at digital rights and that tussle between kind of US approach or EU approach.
Yeah.
Interesting. So if people are listening to this podcast and they want to find out more or they want to do something about this whole area, they are basically concerned, have you got any suggestions of where they should go or what they could do?
Yeah, gladly. And this is just like a blatant opportunity for me to plug Open Rights Group.
That's why I asked the question.
Appreciate the platform. Well, yeah, so, I mean, like I said, Open Rights Group are a membership-based organisation. We have local groups across the UK, from London to Manchester to Birmingham, and including in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Aberdeen. We aren't able to meet physically at the moment, but it is a community of kind of engaged individuals who are concerned about these issues, want to contribute, often professionals in the technology sector who understand the intricacies of technology much better than I. And so they're kind of a real source of knowledge and usefulness and a kind of link into a community that you don't normally, if you're not part of the tech community, so to speak, it's quite difficult to know what's going on. But actually, we've got groups here who are really nice, really approachable, and really keen to kind of help people understand this stuff a little bit better. And so I'd recommend coming onto our website, openrightsgroup.org, or specifically scotland.openrightsgroup.org, and you'd be able to kind of see where our current campaigns, one of which is on digital trade, and also where our next events are going to be held and who's holding them. And a lot of them are online. Well, actually, all of them are online right now. And you can just come along and join them and begin to learn a little bit more. And yeah, I think if I was to say to a human rights activist, rather than a kind of like more so than just an engaged or concerned member of the public, I would recommend, even for your own issue that you may be attached to, that the future of these debates will reside often in the discussion around trade and our relationship with countries or bodies like the European Union. And so the more you can begin to understand the intricacies of trade, the more you can begin to understand and engage in that, the better prepared you will be as an advocate and activist for your cause to respond to it. It's not an easy fight by any stretch. And there are plenty of organizations like Trade Justice Movement who have been in these fights for a lot longer. And, you know, if you really wanted to learn a bit more about that, I'd recommend visiting their website. That's where these issues are going to head. And I encourage people to kind of begin to think about this as a kind of front line of our campaigning objectives or roles and responsibilities in the years to come.
I think that's really interesting because it must be said, I think a lot of organizations don't hugely look at trade because it just seems so complex and something kind of beyond our borders almost, but it's going to have such a big impact in our sort of post-Brexit world. So it's a good siren call there to find out more about it, in particular how it affects different rights issues. So thanks, Matt. That's been really interesting. Thank you for your expertise and your insight, which are hugely useful. And thanks.
Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.